Hey there, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Hugo Is There podcast. This is the first year where I am a voting member of the Worldcon. And though I don't have the bandwidth to read all of the nominees for best novel, I do have the bandwidth to read some of the shorter stuff and to watch shorter stuff as well. And so I wanted to get a panel together to talk about the short stories. I'd kind of like to do more than one of these, maybe do one for novelettes as well, maybe do dramatic presentation. But I wanted to start with just one of these. So I put a feeler out on Twitter and I got quite a few responses and I'm 90% sure I missed somebody. So if that's you and you're out there, I do apologize. But given my level of organization, it's an absolute miracle that this happened at all. So like I said, I might want to do another one of these. And if I did miss you, then reach out to me and I'll get you on the next one. So I do have awesome people here. As I mentioned, we're on Zoom for this. And so there is video for this. And I'm definitely going to post this on the Patreon page. I don't know if I'm going to post it anyplace else. The audio will go into the normal feed. So with that, let's go ahead and go around and introduce everybody. You'll recognize a lot of these voices if you are a listener to the podcast, but there are a few people who have never been on the podcast. And so I want to start by introducing them. So let's go ahead and start with Cora. By the way, just start by, you know, saying your name, where you're from, what people might know you from. So Cora.
I'm Cora Bulat. I'm from Bremen in North Germany. And I'm a blogger for at my own site and at Galactic Journey. I'm also a writer and I comment about the Hugo finalists almost every year. And I'm actually a two-time Hugo finalist myself for best fan writer. Yes. So I'm not in the short story category. And yeah, I'm glad to be here. And I know Seth because in the run-up to the 2021 Hugo Awards, I interviewed a whole lot of podcasters eligible in the fan cast category. As well as fan cast, as well as fan scenes and bloggers. And yeah, that's, I think, enough about me.
Cool. I was going to make sure that you did the self-promotion to say that you're a Hugo nominee for this year. So people should definitely put you on their ballots. Okay, let's go ahead and go over to Ivor.
Greetings from central Scotland in the United Kingdom. I'm just a 50-year-old reader of stuff, quite like short stories, quite like sci-fi, quite like listening to podcasts. Really quite boring, to be honest, but that's me.
Okay, nice. All right, and then I think our only other new face is Alan.
My name is Alan Bailey. I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the United States. And you might know me from a podcast called If This Goes On, Don't Panic. And I also used to run a podcast called Alan Jeremy versus Science Fiction.
Nice.
A few years ago. So
cool. Yeah. I like If This Goes On just because it kind of takes a positive spin on things.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So then the not new faces. Let's start with JW. I'm just kind of going in order on my screen.
All right. Yeah. I'm JW Wartick. I am at the blog Eclectic Theist. I was on the podcast for Dream Snake, which was just an absolute thrill for me. Also, first time Hugo voter. So I'm really excited to dive into the short stories. I did read all the novels as well. I just think this whole year has just a great slate. So I'm excited to be here and talk with everyone else.
Okay. All right. How about Lisa?
Hi, I'm Lisa Andreasen. I'm Danish, a Trekkie, Asimov fan, Pratchett fan, Doctorow fan, blogger, podcaster, short story fan, Worldcon member, Hugo voter, fan of everything that promises I will only read quality. Science fiction author, article author, translator, computer scientist, teacher, and my Goldfield fan.
Nice. Somebody wrote down their blurb. Okay, now to Lori.
Hi, I'm Lori, and I am from Atlanta, Georgia in the United States, and I am one of the three co-hosts of the Hugo Girl podcast.
Nice. So over to another one of your co-hosts, Amy.
Hello, I am Amy. I am also from Atlanta. I am also one of the three co-hosts of the Hugo Girl podcast. Also, just a general reader of things that are science fiction and fantasy, also fairly boring, like keyboard.
And also our gracious host for the Zoom call. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins. I'm a longtime science fiction fan from my many collections my father had of analog and so on. I've attended a lot of science fiction conventions. I work in DevOps in Maryland. I have guested on Seth's Patreon podcast. I talked about Connie Willis's Bellwether with him. And I've guested on a couple of other podcasts, the Incomparables, Supergirl, Supercast, and the Skiffy and Fanti podcast when they were talking about one of the Bujold books. And nice. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I will say the Comfort Reads episodes are in the main feed, not just the Patreon.
Oh, thank you. Great. Yeah.
Okay, last but not least, Haley.
Hey, I am also in Atlanta from the Hugo Girl podcast, and I'm really into Star Wars.
Awesome. Okay, so let's go ahead and dive into this. The first story that I have, actually, I'll just go ahead and give the list of stories first, and then we'll go through them in this order. So we have Open House on Haunted Hill by John Wiswell, which was published by Diabolical Plots. And then we have Badass Moms in the Zombie Apocalypse, which wins for title for me, by Ray Carson from Uncanny Magazine. Then we have A Guide for Working Breeds by Vinaji Mean Prasad in Made to Order Robots and Revolution. And we have Metal Like Blood in the Dark by T. Kingfisher from Uncanny. The Mermaid Astronaut by Yoon-Ha Lee, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, and Little Free Library by Naomi Kritzer. So we're going to go through them in that order, and I ask for volunteers for people to kind of do a little recap of them, and then we'll just kick off the conversation. Just an open forum, anybody who wants to talk about it can. I don't have a hard cutoff in mind for how long we talk about each story, but let's just see how it flows. Looks like we lost somebody. I think we lost Sarah. She's not the recapper for this one, so I'm going to go ahead and plow ahead. So Open House on Haunted Hill, and our recapper is Lori.
Hey, so I'm excited to recap this story because I really, really liked it. So Open House on Haunted Hill is very short, so I'll try to make the summary very short. Basically, this is the story of a house, 133 Poisonwood Avenue, and it takes place during an open house where a realtor is trying to sell the property. And the house is the main character of the story. And sort of through the lens of the house, thinking about its history, we learn that houses have personalities, that they have attachments and relationships to the people who live in them. And this particular house has been mostly uninhabited since about 1989. And so it is just desperate for a family to move in. And it kind of sets its sights on a father and daughter who attend the open house. And it just really wants them to live there. And so we see it kind of just trying to impress the people who are coming through and trying to be the house that they need. And so we see the house do its very best to meet the needs of the people who are coming to it. And it does that through the form of kind of a benevolent haunting.
Right.
So that's the kind of the recap of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this one kind of falls into fantasy / horror, even though it's, you know, not frightening.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know that I've ever read a ghost story that didn't try to be scary. You know, I thought that was a really interesting take on, you know, what would a benevolent haunting look like?
Yeah.
And the house itself is very clear that it doesn't believe in ghosts. So I guess it's maybe not exactly right to call it it's a haunting, but it's not necessarily a ghost story.
Right. In this story, we learned that haunted houses can be skeptics. Anybody else have anything to say about this one? I'm sure somebody does. I'm
sure I know after reading this book what I mean when I say the word haunting.
yeah, definitely.
Because the house definitely talks about haunting as just sort of being involved. I don't
know. Right.
Is that what we mean by haunting? I'm not sure anymore.
Yeah.
So this is Sarah. I thought it was interesting. This isn't really a ghost story because the house is sort of personified itself. I've read stories that have smart houses, for instance, that are sort of personified in the same way. And I've read a book where a magician sort of created a persona in a house so that it could run the house more comfortably for them. Mm-hmm. In this one, it just seems to have sort of become emergently, it emerged itself as a persona. I just think it's interesting, these different ways of looking at how, you know, a lot of people kind of want to feel like big things that they inhabit have a little personality. And I was also thinking about how some pilots call their planes, you know, she or baby or, you know, and certainly so many car drivers personify their cars and give them names and so on. Yeah. And I think it's just kind of an impulse. We kind of want to feel a personal relationship with these objects. And, you know, so of course, the author is kind of not really talking directly about that, but flipping it around and telling the story from the point of the view of the house. So, I, you know, it's a sweet story. It talks about how, you know, other houses are more killer instinct. Right. And it just kind of doesn't have the heart for that sort of thing. So, I liked it.
Yeah. I liked the quote. It said, "A killer house," or "the killer houses can't bear to be alone."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really does flip everything about the gothic haunted house subgenre on its head, really. Mm-hmm. Just everything about it. It ends, yeah. Hopefully, you know, nobody really dies in it.
Right. Yeah, it makes me think that I probably, not being a real fan of horror, not having really read any haunted house fiction, that I missed something. I've read some stuff like Sarah mentioned, where it's like a smart house that's become sentient or that kind of thing, the science fiction take on it. And even you mentioned the pilots, Sarah, naming their planes or having a relationship with them. It reminds me of the Love, Death, and Robots episode, Lucky 13, where the craft actually kind of has its own personality.
This one was actually the biggest surprise for me, because all of the others were at least authors I'd heard of, some stories I'd read, but I'd never heard of John Viswell before this one. And I hadn't read the story. And so I thought, like, okay, let's see what this one is. And I was really, really positively surprised. I'm also not a huge horror fan, because a lot of the time it seems to me as if it would be much better than to just exorcise the ghost or the demon,
right.
Or kill the vampire. Just figure out what the hell do they want, and then maybe see if you can come to terms with them. And this is more or less what happens. This house is not evil, it's just lonely. It wants someone to live in it, and it eventually finds this family, which is also a bereaved family, because the mother has died.
Right.
So it's basically two lonely humans and a lonely house, more or less, finding and helping each other. It's a very sweet one, and it actually shot up close to the top of my ballot, which really surprised me, since that was the one where I thought, like, okay, it's probably somewhere down in the doldrums, because I know all the other authors are really, really good. But yeah, we have a really strong ballot this year. This one was a real huge pleasant surprise.
We should mention too that this one did win the Nebula for best short story.
Okay. I did not realize that, so thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. My favorite part of this story, I think, is the part where the daughter wears a locket with her deceased mother's photo in it, and she drops it. They leave the house, and it's not clear that they're going to get the house. They kind of had a moment where the daughter's had a little tantrum, and the dad's just like, I just got to get out of here. And the house is like, oh no. So the daughter has dropped her locket, and it's down in the floorboards, and the house manages to levitate it. And I love this because the house gives the dad what the dad needs, which is a win with the kid, right? So the dad finds the locket, but then the dad doesn't pick it up. And the house is like, oh, what's going on? Did he forget? But then the dad does what the house does. The dad knows what his daughter needs. Mm-hmm. So the dad finds it and then lets the daughter find it herself. And so it's just like this nice chain reaction of caregiving that I thought was just really touching.
Yeah. Yeah. I like this one. Go ahead, JW.
This is JW. Just this past year, I moved out of a house that was built in 1898. So this story actually resonated me in the sense of place and how, you know, it's squeezing its floorboards together and the creepy floorboards. And it really just made me feel about how we think of a sense of home, and seeing it from the home's perspective, it just really, I guess, personalized this story for me in a way that I didn't expect, because I am also not a fan of horror. I haven't read much horror, and I went into the story kind of thinking, oh, I'll read this and it will be one I won't enjoy. And then I was touched by it in a very genuine and personal way. I wept when we left our house, because it was just such a beautiful old house, and this just connected with me and kind of brought those memories back in such a wonderful way.
Yeah. Ivor, I think you were trying to say something and I didn't hear, couldn't really hear you.
Yeah, I'm having a slight issue with my microphone. Can you hear now?
Really, really low.
Really low. That's not helping, is it? Well, my only comment then is I thought it was very much a tip of the hat to Shirley Jackson and her writing as well. Kind of gothic element.
Any other comments, Haley, Amy, or Lisa?
I love haunted horror, haunted house stories. So this one was fun. I mean, I think it's a classic case of, I think he had a really good idea for a pun title, and then he really nailed it by writing it. In a lot of scary movies, the house is a character, and it takes a certain kind of house. You know, like, that's why you don't ever see like a haunted studio apartment or a haunted beach house. Like, it's always got to be like a big gothic mansion. So this one just being, you know, like a bungalow. It's a nice take on it.
Yeah.
We just recorded an episode about a retroactive Hugo winner called The Uninvited. And it's sort of a, it's a 1944 haunted house story. And one of the comments I think Haley made was that, you know, the story is great. It suffers a little bit because of it's missing that part that Haley was talking about, where the haunted house is a character in the story. Like, you really get to know the character, the house, and, you know, that it has to function as a character in order for the character, for the story to have enough depth. And so as I was reading the story, I was thinking, well, this is the exact opposite. The house is actually the main character, which I think really does lend a lot of humanity kind of to the story, and it gives it a lot of depth. And you kind of start rooting for the house. I really liked this house and I want to live in it.
The only tiny little downside I have for this is that it mentions Google Fiber, and that's going to hurt its kind of longevity, because are people going to know what Google Fiber is in 50 years? Maybe that's all that we'll have.
Yeah. I mean, I know what 8-tracks are. So
that's true. Yeah.
Well, and the dad in the story has a hosts a skeptic podcast. And so one day I think podcasting will probably be very dated as well.
Probably. Yeah. All right. Any other comments on this one, or we can move on to next?
The only other thing that I can think of is, while reading this, I just wondered to myself, if you had made an RPG about houses, what powers would the houses have? So maybe that's a non sequitur, but I don't know. It was just something weird that popped into my head while I was reading.
That's a fun thought, Alan. I like that. I would love to play an RPG where we got to play different houses with different powers.
You have to roll an 18 or higher in order to have the room of requirement show up.
Like, houses on a block competing for something or working together for some goal.
Yeah. Okay. So shall we move on to Badass Moms in the Zombie Apocalypse? And plot summary, I have Amy.
Yay. I love this story so much. Badass Moms in a Zombie Apocalypse, as you mentioned, by Ray Carson, and it was in issue 32 of Uncanny Magazine. And the story, you know, takes place, as the title tells you, in a zombie apocalypse. And it follows primarily the characters Britt and Marisol, Mary, as they live in this enclave of, it seems like, mostly women, and Britt is pregnant. So it follows her, and Mari is her partner. And it follows them as they sort of leave the enclave and go to a second remote location to have the baby, because childbirth attracts zombies. So they can't attract them to the enclave. So it follows them on their little journey to the birthing hideout. And then it, as Britt gives birth and various things they encounter, and it sort of ends up being, sort of follows them as they deal with the threat to their lives, then also sort of the miraculous and mundane that comes along with giving birth. And then it also kind of turns into a little meditation on life and death and bringing a child into a dangerous world and that sort of thing. So, I just really liked the characters. And so that, you know, the zombie thing is definitely been done, but I think this one was saved a little bit by the characters and the women and the way they view each other and view their world. And it was just kind of a delight to hang out with them for a while.
Nice. All right. Anybody else? What do you want to say about this one, Lisa?
Yeah, I had two thoughts. The first is that there's something going on where it's very violent to give birth to a child. Mm-hmm. It's also very violent to be in a container surrounded by zombies.
Mm-hmm.
The second thought is that they have a strategy. When you're giving birth, you have to be outside of the village. So that the village won't be overrun by zombies. And you run your own while you're out there, you and maybe a partner. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they choose not to follow that strategy. And I'm not sure. I don't really like this idea that, because they love Britt, they come to her aid and they all survive. It's, you had a strategy, follow it.
From a tactics point of view, you have to critique it.
Oh, sorry, Haley. I was going to say, I'm with you, because they do reference at one point that, you know, only half of the women who go out to give birth in this birthing hideout come back. So it's clear that in the past they have just sort of let their plan play out, and that if someone disappears, someone disappears. So it is not immediately clear why Britt and Mari get a different outcome. Like, there's sort of a deus ex machina rescue at the end. And it's not super clear why that happens. Although I'm not upset about it, because I really liked them. So,
yeah, it seemed to me like they could go some distance to improving the situation. You know, like figure out how to do a second story container or something that they can climb up a ladder or something. Not that you won't necessarily want pregnant ladies having to climb ladders, but you know, something to keep the zombies off of them.
And in 10 years, we can't build a tunnel.
I thought the title pretty much said what the story was going to be. And that's what the story was. I very much expected all the mothers to come and save them, because I just thought it was going to be that kind of a story. And I didn't really get much out of this story.
Okay. Yeah. The thing that I kind of liked about this was, like you mentioned, I thought they might all come as well. And when you think about the story, you could think about it as just the main couple, Britt and Mari, but it's everybody in that compound is the badass moms of the zombie apocalypse, because they're all kind of taking community ownership of any births that take place. And I like that. And I like just the notion that, and maybe this is just as a sort of as a white dude, I feel like groups other than white dudes take care of each other. And women, I think, and maybe I'm speaking out of some ignorance here because I've never been a woman, but I feel like women take care of each other better than men do.
No argument.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I would say one thing. I think Lori raised her hand, and I don't know who has the hand raising, who has the ability to do the hand raising here. I think it might be me, but I'm wondering if I can give that.
Everybody can do it in reactions. You just click it.
Yeah,
and
it's
then,
in reactions.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so then Seth, can you see when people raise their hand?
Yeah, I can
make sure I'm not the only one who can see it. Okay, great.
All right, yeah, go ahead, Lori.
Thanks. So I wanted to say that I think this story deserves a lot of credit for the suspense. The scene where they're in this shipping container or train car, I was skeptical. I mean, obviously we wouldn't have a story if everything was secure and it all went great and there was no threat. But while I was reading it, I was just like, well, they're going to die. You know, I mean, in a short story, anything can happen. You know, if you have a novel, you can probably assume that all of your major characters are not going to die. Maybe some of them are, but somebody's making it out. But in this story, I thought it is entirely possible that everybody is about to get eaten. And so when I was reading it, I was really like, my husband laughs at me because I will make faces while I'm reading. And so I was reading it like, what's about to happen? It was very evocative. The zombies are rattling the door. The wooden brace that they've put up is starting to splinter. I mean, it just, I was on the edge of my seat while I was reading it, and I couldn't wait to get to the end. And I'm glad that it had a happy ending, but I wasn't sure that it was going to have one. And I felt that you really felt the closeness of the space. I felt the like weight of the undead pressing down on this container. So I think that that was really well executed, and I enjoyed the story a lot. I also appreciate a story that includes menstruation. And they called them menstrual lures to draw the zombies away. And I attended a panel at Dragon Con a couple years ago that specifically talked about menstruation in fiction and how The Walking Dead would go to such great lengths to introduce some blood into a scene. And they talked specifically about one scene where one of the characters like rolls up under a damaged car and gets what looks like a little nick on his arm, and it just starts bleeding profusely. And then that's what draws the zombies and creates the ensuing action. And her point was like, you could have just had a character who was having their period. You know, you didn't have to like throw this guy under a car and suddenly he severs an artery just by grazing his shoulder. So I appreciated that aspect as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I was a big fan of that too. Like the saving the afterbirth as a distraction.
Yeah, I think they have a special room for women who are menstruating, and they call it the sanctum, I think.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the red tent. That's got resonance in history, too. There's a history of that in some cultures, which, you know, it's kind of exclusionary, so not a big fan. But, all right, got some other hands raised, so Alan.
Yeah, so I want to hit on a couple of things that everybody said. I am also tired of zombie stories. I finished the Walking Dead comics this year and I just put them away like, okay, I'm done with zombies for the next 10 years, I think. I do think the strengths of this story, though, are in the language used. I really liked some of the things that she said. Just a quick example, one sentence was, together we ooze out of the train yard like an amoeba of shotguns, which I just really found to be a very amusing image. But and I also think, I agree that the relationships in this story are very strong and well-written. however, I do think there's a real conflict in the strategies here. Like on one hand, we've got like the menstrual lures, which is an excellent strategy, right? Something well thought out. But then again, as someone else said, they come and save them in the end for seemingly no reason. So I feel like there's a real conflict in what's happening there. That's all.
Cool. Cora, I think you had something to say.
Yes. Well, generally, I liked the story for much of the reasons we already discussed. I liked the idea that we have have a bunch of women, a whole enclave of women after the zombie apocalypse, because most post-apocalyptic fiction has tough men with big guns and so on. And yes, there's a woman maybe who needs to be protected. And this is a group of all women. It also brings to mind historical examples, for example, like, well, women's monasteries or abbeys. And also, of course, don't know if this was outside, if this was available outside Germany, but we had something called Beginenhöfe, where unmarried women lived together, and we still have a few like those. They were not religious communities, but I liked this. And yes, the strategies are a bit confused. For example, if they have a room for menstruating, why don't they just have the babies in that room? Would be make more sense. And one thing which brought down the story a bit for me, and this is really a case of day job collides with fiction, because I'm a translator in my day job. I do technical translations for the shipping and also trucking industry, so I know a bit about containers. Mm. And containers don't really work that well. For starters, the regular shipping containers you see are not airtight, because they have to bore a hole in reefer containers. So refrigerated containers are airtight, which are used for shipping foods and so on. And that's also why people sometimes die in those containers. But a regular one is not airtight. I'm also sure a reefer wouldn't be airtight after a couple of years of zombie apocalypse. And also the container locks and doors don't work the way they are described, which is a really little silly thing, but yeah, it took the story down a notch for me. Also, why do they have a wooden bar when they could have used a piece of metal, which would not have corroded as easily because the wood has gotten soggy and rope breaks? But ropes for some reason hold. Okay, so that's just a technical issue. Otherwise, I like the story. It's still a very good story.
Sorry.
No problem. I was finished. Go ahead, Amy.
No, I was just going to say, if they used a metal bar, then the zombies couldn't get in, Cora, and then we wouldn't have a story.
Yeah. Ivor, I think you had your hand up.
Okay. Can you hear me this time?
Yes, you sound great now.
Excellent. We've gone back to analog. My point of view, first of all, not a great fan of zombie stories, but two things. It was really good to see the woman's perspective and really good to see natural things like a menstrual cycle. Yes, a man talking about menstrual cycle, my God. but you don't see it so much about the fact as, you know, in stories as how we deal with these things that happen on a monthly or less basis. Secondly, just a small point that came out when I was reading this. Why is it that in the zombie movies that we see so much of, that they're all gathered around hospitals? Because I work in a hospital and we have a huge amount of bloody clinical waste.
Yeah. So
that's my point, but it was okay.
All right. Okay, JW, fighting the mute.
I'm sorry, it wasn't working to unmute. First of all, thank you, Cora, for that about containers. Now I genuinely want to read some more sci-fi about containers and cargo modules, because that was fascinating. One thing that I thought of as I was reading this story is, and I tried to track it down and I couldn't, but I saw a thread on Twitter some time ago talking about especially lesbians getting killed in speculative fiction and how that basically happened at the end of so many stories. And so as I was reading this, I kind of had this sense of dread of, you know, someone's going to die. And it seemed very sure someone was going to die. So for me, not having them die at the end was just sort of refreshing and reminded me of that discussion I'd seen about speculative fiction and how frequently, not just lesbians, but other just characters that are just across the board minorities of any sort just tend to be like sort of tokenized and killed for the sake of fringe. Emotional reaction. And I appreciated that didn't happen. And just one last thing, I really liked this line that was in the book about how, what kind of world are we making if women can't go after, or if a woman can't go after what she wants? And I just, it really spoke to me. And sort of sealed the whole story for me.
Yeah. Alan, I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, I just want to say, in general, all of these stories were pretty hopeful. I was very surprised by that. It seems like a huge change from the last few years. And I'm not an expert on all the stories from the last few years, but, you know, just thinking back 5 years ago, even, could you imagine this many hopeful stories being on the Hugo list? You know?
Yeah.
And then also want to add something JW said about at the end of the story, they mentioned, they named the little boy Eileen, I believe it was, which because it's a brand new world, right? Which I totally loved. I think that might have been the best part of the entire story there.
Yeah. Cora, I see you've got your hand up.
Yeah, well, adding to what Alan said, I was also really, really happy because last year's Hugo short stories, they were good, but they were all really, really dark and depressing stories, including The Winner. And The Winner was one of the more positive lots, and that was the one where little girls, where nuclear codes are hidden in little girls and they have to be cut off. And that was the hopeful one because they don't cut up the little girl in the end. Mm-hmm. And so I was really happy when I read the first story this year. I was, it's a non-depressing story. And in the end, I was, wow, none of them are depressing. They're all positive stories and hopeful stories. This is really a pleasant change because I was getting a bit weary of all the depressing stories. I'm not sure if this is due to the pandemic that people simply no longer want depressing stories or not as much as they used to, or if it's because of the changed political situation in the U.S., but it's certainly an interesting trend.
Yeah, it's interesting the way the pandemic has affected things. And that's why I started like the Comfort Reads episodes that I did, and why, you know, reading a book like Doomsday Book in 2020 felt very different. I think it was 2021, but yeah. Okay, a couple more comments from Ivor and then Sarah.
Yeah, it's just to pick up on what Alan was saying, the fact that he named the child Eileen, who was a boy, kind of reminded me, I think it's a Johnny Cash song of like a boy named Sue. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to be called a really kind of interesting name, you're going to be fighting for yourself in life. So it gives you strength as well as a bit of character. So it did resonate there as a retrospective reference.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Sarah.
So it's interesting to me that all of the short stories were fairly positive, and that's not true for all of the categories. And it's just, you know, it'd be interesting to think about, you know, why is it that the short stories were all pretty positive, but there were some pretty dark stories in some of the other categories. Just how did that work out? Is it easier to write a happy short story than a happy long story? I'm not sure. But I certainly enjoyed it's hard for me to, I've ranked and re-ranked the stories several times, the short stories, because there's things I like in almost all of them.
Yeah. Lisa, I think you had something else to say.
It's interesting. I haven't been following Walking Dead or anything like that. I'm not really that much into zombies. So I really like this story. And this is just the right amount of zombie for me. I'm not into very gory, very scary horror. So this was just right for me.
All right. Any other comments on this story or we can move on? Go ahead, Lori.
I just wanted to respond to what Sarah said about the other categories not having this sort of hopeful tone. And I wonder if that's because with a novel or even a novella or novelette, those are written over, in general, they're going to be written over a much longer period of time. I mean, I'm not a writer, but I am guessing that, you know, a novel is going to take a lot longer to write in most cases. And so I wonder if short stories as a format are probably better able to respond to the moment that we're in. Mm-hmm. So that may be why we're seeing this kind of trend in this particular category and not necessarily in the other categories. And one thing that I think is also consistent among these is that they are all positive, hopeful stories, but for the most part, there's a really dark backdrop to all of them. And to me, that feels like a very real response to the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. And I think just in general, you've got to do a lot really quickly in short stories because you don't have, you know, 300 to 600 pages to, you know, expand upon things. And it's kind of like TV shows. Like no one wants to see a 2-hour movie about a very happy couple. Like it's just boring. You want to see like cheating and death and war, and it just makes for better entertainment, I think.
Mm-hmm. Even if you look at the kind of the history of Western literature, right? You have Shakespeare, where there's the tragedies and the comedies, but the comedies were not, you know, universally happy the whole time. There was always the moment where everything went wrong before it finally, you know, we ended with a wedding.
Oh yeah, comedies were just ones that didn't have a lot of death in them.
yeah, pretty much. Okay, so. We want to go ahead and move on to A Guide for Working Breeds. I have Alan for the recap on that one.
Okay, so here's my recap. An intelligent robot wakes up to meet their mentor. The mentor guides them through a difficult work situation and the relationship grows. And the entire story is written through IMs, texts, emails, and alerts. It was very a very snarky, political, and hopeful and creative feels to it. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I'm not sure how cheery the backdrop of this one is, because I felt like where it's talking about being mean to people, and one of the bots is referred to as Constant Killer, and I'm like, is the bot killing other bots or is it killing people?
I felt with the sense of humor throughout the story and in the positive relationships in there, that it really, even though there was kind of a negative backdrop, and it was also implied that the robots are basically enslaved,
right,
or have a very terrible working situation. But the way that the relationships ended and the positivity of the one robot really, to me, made it a positive story overall.
Yeah. Sarah, I see you've got your hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to the catalog of communication in that story. You have a record of a search history, which was also very funny to me. I really loved the creative ways of moving the story along in this without having two people sitting there talking to each other. And in a way, I've seen that in a few stories now, I think another story by the same author. And in a way, it's sort of a modern epistolary story, where instead of letters exchange, you're seeing it's moved beyond letters. Thinking back to Dracula's lovely use of news clippings and journal entries and phonograph recordings. And that's not what I want every story to be, but I think Yoon-Ha Lee did it very well in this story.
Yeah. Actually, it's Ina Jimin Prasad, not Yoon-Ha Lee.
Right. Yeah. Different author.
Oh, I'm so sorry. The author. I'll just stick to that.
There we go. I would say I'd fix it in post, but with this many participants, there's no way I'm editing anything. Okay, Lisa, you have your hand up. You found the button, but forgot the mute button.
There it is.
There we go.
On my reread over this week, this was the story I liked best. It was just really, really charming. Mm-hmm. And I'm normally a cat person, but dogs are good as well. Cute dogs. I just love it. This is part of the hopeful trend. This story just made me happy. Also, by the way, the first three stories we've talked about, that's the three stories that were also nominated for Nebula.
Nice. I'm definitely a dog person. That's what won me over for this one. This one I read while walking through an airport, which is not a great way to read a story. And I completely bounced off it. I did not get it. And then I reread it yesterday and really enjoyed it. So I gave all of these two reads. And so if you bounce off one the first time, you might want to go back and check them out. Let's see. Amy, you got your hand.
I was going to sort of piggyback off what, now I'm not sure who said it, but the sort of alternative narrative structure that was used for this one, I love it when people can do that well. And I thought one of the best parts about this story to me was how well the author imbued personality into the people using only very spare lines of chat text, which, you know, anybody, now we all know that that dog's adorable.
I know it's cheating.
I mean, we all know in today's day and age that we all know that, you know, you can tell a lot, you know, from how people respond in chats, and sometimes tone gets lost in chats, and sometimes things come across as terse when they're not supposed to be terse. And, you know, it's just, it's an endless interesting thing to me how we read tone and personality into very short little messages that we send to each other now. And I thought that the author did a really great job of telling us who these people are using very spare text that we now have the ability to read a lot into, because this is how we communicate. You know, if this story had come out 10 years ago, it would have, I don't know that it would carry the same connotation, I guess, because we have now all have experience with this kind of communication. I just thought that was really interesting.
Go ahead, Cora.
Well, we have a sort of a trend for robot stories at the moment. And what makes them different from the robot stories of the 1940s is not only that we actually have robots, these, even if they're mostly just lawnmower robots or something like, or vacuum cleaning robots, but also that the modern robot stories are often told from the point of view of the robot, which is something that Asimov didn't do until the 1970s and only very sparsely. So, It's apparently because we are close enough to artificial intelligence that we have to think and worry about, like, how are these beings? How can we treat them? Do they have feelings? And yeah, so we've had a flurry of these robot or sometimes spaceship point of view stories. There was Cat Pictures, Please, by Naomi Kritzer, which isn't a robot, but it's actually an internet search engine, which has become sentient. Or there was, of course, Ancillary Justice is sort of falls into that category. Or also by Veena Jimin Prasad, Fandom for Robots, about a robot who writes fan fiction. And the Murderbot stories, which are actually nominated into categories again this year. So it's a trend. And yes, what sets this one apart is really the format with the text messages, because otherwise it would be, oh yes, it's another robot point of view story. It's kind of nice, but we've seen it before. But yes, the format makes a difference. Also, I kind of love that Constant Killer eventually changes his name to Corgi Kissa, and becomes a lot more positive character and apparently stops killing Yael. Whatever, it's not quite sure if he's killing other robots or if he's just killing people, we don't know, but at any rate, he stops doing that.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to what Alan was talking about the positivity in some of these stories, is you see the Constant Killer start off as your Roy Kent, for lack of a better term, to put it in Ted Lasso terms, where the other one is more like your Ted Lasso bubbly, really just kind of leans into the dog thing, you know, like really happy and bubbly and wanting to say hi to everybody. And the other one is just more of a cat, I guess. It's like, no, just leave me alone. Lisa, I saw you had your hand up.
I wanted to address this whether the killer is killing people or what. My feeling is that both of these robots are taking human jobs, like... the killer describes himself as a freelancer and the other runs a cafe. These are human jobs that have just lately been given to robots instead, complete with worker exploitation and the whole package. So killer just happens to be number four on the top 10 list. So he becomes a target. So that's my reading of it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Sarah?
Yeah, so following on these points, there's more fiction, more science fiction now, which looks at the lives of laborers and not just Horatio, look at the little person making it big stories, but actually looking at systemic issues, economics and ethics, exploitation, which I see as a very positive trend in science fiction to, you know, be taking a look, a good hard look at, you know, what does it mean when you talk about this kind of world or this kind of future? So I find those pretty interesting for the most part. So.
Yeah, and I will say, I know that Androids and Assets is doing a series on these, and I'm curious what they'll say about some of that in this story in particular. And then I'd also refer people over to the Hugo Awards Book Club, because they've done a lot of writing about labor unions in science fiction. Lori?
I'm glad that Cora brought up Murderbot Diaries. I've been reading those, so I wanted to read all the novels and that were nominated this year, so I... luckily was able to get all the Murderbot Diaries pretty much from my library. And so I've read them all very recently and I really enjoy them. So I think anybody who liked this story would also enjoy those. Mm-hmm. When I was reading this story and I got to the end of it, this is kind of where I'm hoping that our protagonist in Murderbot will end up, with this kind of peace that our two main characters in this story have found. You know, the world is still not great. Sounds like, you know, by the end of the story, they've got their little dog cafe and they're happy, but things are still not great for artificial intelligence. But for the two of them, they found a place where they can have some peace and some contentment. And when I read that, I was like, I really hope that Murderbot ends up here, you know, whether it's that it likes dogs or it becomes a cat person or, you know, it becomes a possum person, because one of our narrators in this story is good friends with a possum. I really hope that that's where that ends up for that character too. So I think anybody who enjoyed this story would enjoy Murderbot and vice versa.
Yep. Sarah, I saw you had your hand up, and then Alan.
Just that the newbie character, the new AI from the start of the story, pays it forward at the end. The AI, you know, wants to help this other new construct that's assigned to it as a mentor. And so he's passing it along to it, the same hack and legal research files that Constant Killer passed it at the first. Constant Killer, who became Corgi Kisser.
Yeah. Any other comments on this one? Oh, what furry pet do you have there, JW?
This is my cat, Nimitz.
I showed my dog Ender a few minutes ago. Aw.
All right, I'm going to show off my dog. She's this is her dead deer cosplay.
Ah, yes.
She's a greyhound. She's skinny and tan and basically just sleeps all the time. So
yes,
that's her, that's her frequent pose.
All right. Anything else on this one or we can move on? Okay. Next one is Metal Like Blood in the Dark. And I have Ivor as the recapper.
Yep. I have a better wake up and get his notes ready. Okay, the recap. Tried not to make this look a school essay, but let's go. Okay, there's a man on a planet who is a father and also an inventor, and he creates two enormous machines called Brother and Sister. They are just machines, but they start self-development, they start self-knowledge, become slightly more self-aware as they go along. But unfortunately, the father becomes unwell, has to go away, and he doesn't trust, which I think is a reference to mankind, doesn't trust mankind coming and seeing them. So he sends them away to make life for themselves. And they go away looking for food because they're driven by the desire to eat metal. And then they become captive of a more powerful machine or being who then allows the sort of kind of self-development in the sister to take on things that we see as children, such as lying, etc. It was an interesting kind of, basically along the lines of a tale of survival for the two machines.
Yeah.
And that's my recap.
Yep. And this is kind of following on from the previous story as a robot story. And this one kind of is too. These are AIs that are embodied.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other comments. Let's start with JW.
In my opinion, this was the strongest prose-wise of the stories. I think that the writing was just almost lyrical at times, the way it talks about Sister just digging into the earth and tasting the elements there. So I found it just very enjoyable to read for that reason alone. But also, I was really struck by when they encountered the villain and how this sort of like loss of innocence occurred, but how that was like necessary for the characters to get to sort of survive. And I've been thinking about that ever since. I'm not sure where I'm landing on that, but I almost wonder like, what does that say about our own world where like this sort of innocent, don't know right from wrong is almost like necessarily banned if you're going to survive. It's sort of haunting me.
Yeah, I agree. Let's go with Amy and then Sarah.
So this story to me was the most interesting one we read. And I think just going back to what JW just said about the loss of innocence, to me, this is a recasting of the Adam and Eve story.
Yes.
So you have this creator who creates these innocent beings and doesn't factor in the ability to lie or deceive or anything. And normally in the Adam and Eve story, we get Eve, who is cast as a villain, right? She comes into contact with the snake and the Satan or however you want to look at it. But, you know, she's taught how to deceive and she's taught to want worldly things. And she's taught, you know, that she's taught various things and she ends up betraying the people in the garden, right? And they get cast out and there's this whole thing. So in this story, Sister comes into contact with a deceitful being. She learns about being deceitful, but instead of it being a betrayal, she does it to protect. And I think it was a very resonant way of recasting the story, especially I don't know, in today's day and age, I guess. But and then them leaving the garden was a necessity, and her protecting her brother and keeping him innocent. And I very much want to read a lot of women and men dynamic into this. Like, women have to know how to deal with things that they protect other people from. And you know, you could read a lot into that. But to me, it was mainly interesting how she took the Adam and Eve story and turned it around and made the sister who betrays and learns how to deceive into a protector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you kind of what you're talking about there with I see there's a privilege thing. We've learned a lot about privilege in you know, recent times. And one example I always use is like a male privilege thing. As I was telling my wife one time, I went for a run and we have a school not far from our house. And I went at night and I ran around the back of the school and finished my run. And I told my wife, man, it was amazing. It was just like being in a sensory deprivation tank because it was completely dark. And she said, yeah, women don't run in those places. And I went, oh, right. And I, you know, I had the luxury of not having that knowledge. And, you know, now I do. Go ahead, Sarah.
So it was beautiful writing. I read it out loud, the whole thing, to my sister last night. It's just so well done there. There's also a lot of alien thinking in it. I think it is one of the most alien written stories, because you have the stuff where sister, for instance, you know, cuts off part of herself to feed to brother so that brother can make the wings to fly them out of the garden, as Amy put it. The parts where the sister is sussing out about there can be lies, you know, this coming from a perspective where she doesn't have that thought pattern to trying to work out how to even articulate to herself what's going on here. I really, really loved that part of the writing. And then also I lost it. So hands down.
All right. How about Ivor?
Yeah, I've already touched on the Adam and Eve. And I think there's also a couple of kind of Greek elements to it as well, if you look at some of the classical stories. But one thing that kind of stood out to me is having the other half as a teacher, not in this household, but elsewhere. And we talk about in conversations about women, girls and boys and their development. And girls do develop faster than boys and become more adaptable. More resilient probably than children. I saw that in the story, that you know, the boy was doing the kind of brutish work, the manual labor, but the girl was doing the thinking, planning, and seeing the end of things, where I don't think the brother saw much of an end to anything other than perhaps maybe death. I thought it was a great story. It's one of my two favorites in this.
Cora, you have your hand up.
Well, this one combines actually two trends we've seen in recent years. We've had the robot story trend, and of course it's another, well, artificial intelligence or robot story, and it's another trend because we've had a trend for fairy tale retellings in recent years. We have another fairy tale retelling on this ballot this year, which we will come to later, but this one is basically Hansel and Gretel in space and with robots, and instead of the gingerbread house is a giant spaceship full of really tasty metal. After all, the robots, they don't need gingerbread or candy. And the wicked witch is instead the evil robot third drone. And again, as in Hansel and Gretel, it's the sister, it's a girl who takes care of the evil witch to save and protect her brother, which is, of course, also historically girls. And also today, girls are still responsible for siblings, even if the siblings are about the same age, because like Hansel and Gretel are twins and these are also like twins. They're the same age, but yes, it gives you the girls who are responsible. And I'm not a huge fan of the fairy tale retelling trend, because the early ones were often like, oh, it's Cinderella or Snow White, but she's lesbian, or she's black this time around, bound, or it's more feminist. And and quite often, at least in Europe, we've had films from the Czech Republic, fairy tale films, which did a lot of interesting things with old fairy tales. They didn't have black or lesbian characters. Simply wasn't the time. It was from the 70s and 80s. But we had feminist Cinderellas and so on. So a lot of those were like, okay, that's nice, but that's basically like a 1970s Czech fairy tale movie. But this one, and also the other fairy tale retelling on the ballot, really do something different. They don't. They go away from the whole fairyland and the fantasy setting into a science fiction setting. Here we have robots and a very, very alien landscape. And the other one is also very, very alien. And yes, so I think that's an interesting way forward for the popular fairy tale retelling.
Yeah, that's a cool reading of it. Lisa, why don't you go ahead and go next, and then Laurie.
Cora, I didn't pick up on the, and Amy, I didn't pick up on the Adam and Eve connection at all. I'm sort of annoyed right now that I didn't. But I have a problem with this story, and I don't think the Adam and Eve connection really fixes it. Why didn't he learn then how to lie?
Why didn't he teach them? I think
there's something, I mean, as a parent myself, there's something to the idea of, like, even if you look at something like belief in Santa Claus, like you want to keep your children innocent as long as possible before sending them out into the world. And it can be a handicap if it goes on too long. And so, I mean, you're right. That's definitely something that he maybe should have thought of before leaving them. I do like, though, that the first inkling of her learning deception is just the statement in her mind, I do not trust the other. Lori, go ahead.
So when I was reading the part where she was teaching herself how to lie, I thought of 2001, Space Odyssey, which I read recently, and hopefully I'm not spoiling it for anybody. It's, you know, it's from the 60s, so right. Hopefully people know how it ends, or if they've seen the movie, they know how it ends. But I thought about that because I wondered, you know, what's going to happen? Is she going to be able to learn how to do this and make it work, or is it going to go horribly wrong, like when Hal is given a command to lie to the crew in 2001. And of course, that's what causes Hal to come undone and things go very badly after that. And it's because he's been given two inconsistent commands and he can't reconcile them. And then, you know, everything sort of breaks down after that. And so I thought of that immediately when she was trying to hold in her mind, she's looking at this pebble and trying to teach herself to think a falsehood about the pebble. The pebble is black in this part of my mind and the pebble is brown in this part of my mind. And so that was a little suspenseful for me because I read it very recently. I read 2001 very recently. So I thought there's potential for this to be catastrophic for Sister. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course it went very differently and it enabled her to save herself and her brother and hopefully eventually be able to reunite with her father. But I just thought it was an interesting way to show how that process worked in her mind and the different outcome from what we've seen in science fiction before.
Yeah. Sarah, why don't you go ahead next?
So there's a line, this is a black pebble, that Sister starts telling herself. And I really liked that as part of the storytelling, the writing, where you'll just see it repeated and you'll remember that Sister is trying to remember this is lying, this is how lying works. And it's a way of Sister trying to hold it together kind of while dealing with this weird way of thinking that she doesn't like. The other thing I thought of when Hal was being talked about was there's an old C.J. Cherry series where a human realizes that this specific alien breed specific alien race, whatever you want to call it, they can't cope with lies. Their brains can't work with lies. And this species has been kind of dominating all of them. And he realizes, oh, we can play them. And people just didn't realize their minds were that alien. And so that if you have a species that has this kind of race memory, that if you put a lie in, it's going to really mess up the entire species. So it's a weapon of war. There hasn't been a lot of fiction science fiction where that kind of thing has been dealt with. And I recommend if people are interested in that thing to go back and read. It's one of her most old series. I think one of the book names is Kutath, Kutath. I'll put in chat what the name is.
Cool. Cora, go ahead.
Well, about what Laurie just said, actually it's a huge trope from all over science fiction going back to the 1940s that robots can't lie. And it's also long lasting. I mean, Hal, of course, has a problem lying and it lasts well into the Star Trek era. I mean, Data can't lie. I think that's a plot point in a few episodes. And one case where really lying makes a robot blow up happens in a very early Asimov robot story. It's a liar. I think it's the first, actually, Susan Calvin story. And I think also the first one where the three laws of, or one of the first where the three laws of robotics are mentioned. And in the end, the robot starts lying to make people feel better about themselves. And in the end, Susan Calvin more or less blows the robot up by telling it, okay, you didn't make me feel better by lying. I never really liked that story because that's the one where Susan Calvin falls in love with someone. And I didn't like that. I liked Susan simply because she did not have interest, any kind of romantic interest. She was apparently asexual. But so robot can't lie, or if the robot lies, it will blow up is a really common trope. And this is, of course, an interesting reworking of that trope.
Lisa, go ahead.
Sarah mentioned aliens who can't lie. I think it's a part of Embassy Town. These aliens, they speak very directly. They never use images in their language or metaphor or anything like that. And therefore, they can't lie. They are experimenting with it, but not really getting anywhere. I think it changes by the end of the book, but it's part of their alienness too.
Yeah, it reminds me of Galaxy Quest. The Thermians don't have any concept of deception. Ivor, why don't you go ahead?
Yes, to pick up, say about the, you say parents don't teach their children to lie. The children learn to lie without parental influence. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I think that it is an experiment. If I say this is, you know, this is the brown pedal, what I'm going to say, it's black. It's about deception. And I personally don't have, I think I'll look forward to seeing future stories where we start seeing AI learning how to lie and to deceive, because it's very much in our image.
Yeah, unfortunately. Amy, go ahead.
I was sort of thinking about, I'm going to start this thought and it's not going to have an end, so I apologize in advance. But I was sort of thinking about this chicken and the egg idea. Like, do you learn how to lie out of an interest in deceiving someone, or do you learn how to lie because someone deceives you? Like, it's sort of this, she has this moment where she realizes she doesn't trust him, and she has to come around to the idea, well, I don't trust him because he's not telling me true things. And if he's not telling me true things, then I can say untrue things. You know, she does this, this number. But I think kids might actually learn to deceive out of a desire for something. You know, they sort of figure out at some point that they can bend the truth. And I don't know. And then they sort of learn that because they're doing that. Yeah. Self-preservation is a good way to put it. Or self-preservation, because it's a desire for something for whatever reason. But then they learn to do this. And then when they learn to do it, they realize that other people are doing it too. And so they can't trust them. So it's the other way around. So I was just mulling that over as we were talking. And that's the non-end of that thought.
I was talking with my wife at some point about like deception and the way we deceive ourselves, because I had gotten a traffic ticket that I was completely guilty of. And I went into the traffic court, you know, getting ready, waiting in line with everybody, and everybody else there was innocent. And it was hilarious listening to how everybody else thought they were innocent. I thought, I mean, not that I don't want to fit in here, but I definitely didn't stop at that stop sign. So yeah. Go ahead, Sarah.
Just that there is a part in the story where Sister actually thinks, you know, articulates to herself that the predatory robot creature, whatever it is that has a hold of them at some point, that she realizes he thinks everyone is lying, because he does this insertion of a thing into the brother to read the brother and make sure that brother isn't lying to him. She figures that out. And so she's saying, oh, he thinks everyone is lying because he lies. And so, yeah, Amy, you know, that definitely is part of an exploration of the story of, you know, when are we projecting? When are we learning from others' behaviors? And when are we looking at our own behavior and thinking everyone else must be the same? Yeah, that was there was a lot of interesting stuff in the story, and that's why it's my top story.
I started wondering if my trust issues come because I'm an inherently deceptive person, you guys.
Yeah. Any other comments on this one?
I got a little bit of the vibes from, has anybody seen Raised by Wolves, which is a TV show by Ridley Scott? And there's like in the first episode, there's two robots and this mother and father, and they're raising human kids. And it's not like the story, but it just gave me the same like brother, sister, mother, father vibes.
Yeah. Any other comments on this one? All right, we can go ahead and move on. We have a couple left. So The Mermaid Astronaut is the next one, and Haley is our recapper.
All right. I'm going to preface this with the first time I read this, I hated it. And then I read it again. And then I read the actual Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale to get some, you know, original primary source comparison. And now I like it. So basically, it's a retelling of The Little Mermaid, not the Little Mermaid version, which is very sanitized. I recently rewatched it as well. The very dark, very gruesome and sad fairy tale. So Esmeralda is a mermaid. She is obsessed with space. I'm not sure why she is. No one else seems to be, even though she comes from a race of mermaid navigators. And she decides that she wants to go to space. And then one day, space traders come to town, which is like a cool riff on, you know, sailors at a port, you know, in Portugal or something. And she doesn't want to meet them at first because she's like, it's just going to make me want it more. But then she ends up doing it and she loves it. And then she decides that she's going to do what it takes to go to space, even though there's no water in these spaceships. So she goes and sees the sea witch who, unlike in The Little Mermaid and Hans Christian Andersen version, does not want a tit for tat exchange. She just says, you know, I'm going to give you this knife that's going to let you cut off your tail and grow legs, and then just come see me when you want to come home. Mm-hmm. So she goes to space. I think the best part of the story is the world building in space. You know, she basically is like a character in, if anybody's read A Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, you know, just working on a cargo ship in space, doing physics and smelling like oil. It felt very real. And I loved her little snake person mentor who just seems so kind. I was imagining the frog lady from the Mandalorian episode. And then she finally realizes after she studies special relativity, which is a little bit of like the plot is a little clunky and it's a little corny sometimes, but all of a sudden she's like, oh shit, time dilation.
Right.
What time is it? And she's like, I got to go home. And they're like, well, you just learned about relativity. Let's take you home. And so she goes home and she goes, sees the witch, and the witch is like, oh man, I forgot to tell you about time dilation. Sorry. And then she becomes her only thing is like, well, my only caveat was now you got to be the witch. And she's like, well, is my sister that I love still around? She's like, just barely, just go see her. And then the ending, maybe y'all can explain it to me. I think it just could have ended with like hugging her sister, but she says, I now know that after traveling around, I understand the motions of celestial bodies. I didn't need to leave home in order to journey through the universe. Not the greatest ending. And like, you know, we talked about prose earlier, like the prose in this, I actually texted Lori and Amy. Parts of it remind me of, we did an episode where we read a short story that I wrote when I was 13. And it's very similar in terms of like the plot jumps and like, woo, all right, that's it. Okay, cool. So it kind of reminded me of that. But yeah, that is the tale of the mermaid astronaut.
All right. Alan, why don't you go ahead and react?
So I had a very opposite reaction to the story for the most part. I just love the juxtaposition of the pure fantasy and then the science fiction stuff that's even in the title, Mermaid Astronaut. I first just read this one randomly right when it came out. And it stuck in my mind since then. And I was surprised and delighted to see that it made the Hugo list. For me, that's the main thing about the story, is that constant shift between these fantasy creatures and then this space opera kind of feel. And then, as you say, you know, you got relativity stuck in there too. And that's like a major plot point of the whole thing. So how does relativity work in a fantasy world? You know what I mean? And just that kind of gray, gooey area really made me love this story a lot.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, why don't you go ahead and comment?
You're welcome. Hans Christian Andersen wrote a story for the world to enjoy. This story didn't work for me. There's not enough conflict. I hate to say it like that, but can I get legs? Oh yeah. Can I go on your starship? Sure. Can I go back now? Oh yeah, we'll figure it out. No, it's too easy. I think Haley said something similar. No.
All right, Sarah, what about you?
So this story did work for me. I think good writing means you don't have to have fighting. I liked the visual details. I liked the koi markings versus the stripes on the tails, for instance. I liked the ending. It worked for me. I feel like her, you know, she'd always been wanting to be out there. And she realized, you know, after being in space, oh, I was in space. I was already out there. You know, it's not the same as being on a spaceship, but right. You know, for me, that worked. You know, she'd had the experience out there. There are plenty of people who, you know, go to sea and are then happy to come home again. I love the diverse ship crew and the ship life, as was mentioned. But I did think, so, okay, the ship has only land animals on it, but I thought of David Brin's books where right. the dolphins have suits they live in and walk around on ships where it's mostly, you know, walkers, land creatures on it, you know. And, of course, she might not have even known to ask. The mermaid might not have even known to ask the ship, could you work me up a suit where I could be on the ship for a few years? She just didn't think to ask of that. So for me, you know, I mean, I like ambient books where you're swimming along in the atmosphere. I like slice of life books where it's just somebody working in a bakery or whatever, and there doesn't have to be some huge conflict to have interesting things about people and relationships and desires in them. I also liked the dedication, the author's dedication to his sister at the end. I felt like that was at least read aloud in the podcast episode I listened to it of it this morning, and I just felt like, yeah, that was kind of meaningful too, with, you know, the author's relationship with his sister, that he really wanted to call it out, the way that the sister, the mermaid who goes spacefaring in this story, sings her sister's name on every planet she visits, keeping that relationship alive, that her sister asked for it before she went spacefaring, and that she did that singing on every planet, which really kept them connected in a way. So I liked the story a lot. It wasn't my top, but I think there was a lot to it.
Yeah. One thing I did like about this story is that so many, not necessarily space operas, but in stories in general, right? You don't often have a meeting of cultures where everything goes well. And here the traders are just interested in trade and exchange of knowledge and that kind of stuff. And I think that's lovely. They do mention that there's pirates as well, but that probably goes back to its roots in the Little Mermaid story and with, you know, shipping on the high seas where there's trade, although trade lots of times in those days was exploitative. But also pirates. Amy, why don't you go ahead?
I like the story sort of on a very basic fairy tale level. You know, it's extremely basic level. She yearns to leave home, leaves home, realizes she loves home, come back. Okay. But what I liked most about this story is that it showed how good metal like Blood in the Dark is. Because to me, that is the correct way to do a fairy tale retelling. This story seemed like this story just seemed too beat for beat, I guess, to be a retelling of the Little Mermaid story for me. Like it was sort of, it was a retelling, but it was almost an exact retelling, which is, I'm not sure where the point was, I guess. Like, why are we doing this? What are we learning new from this?
See, I didn't even get that because I haven't ever read The Little Mermaid and the movie.
Beat for beat might be a little bit
of
an exaggeration. I mean, there are differences, but it was close enough to me that I just don't know if it added much to the story or brought it forward enough for me. I don't know.
Alan, you had a comment.
Yeah, this isn't a super important comment, so I'll just start with that. I do like the diversity of the crew. The bird captain reminded me of that psychic bird thing in Cat Valente's space opera novel quite a bit. Just a random thing. It also reminds me of the crew in Cat Rambo's new book, You Sexy Thing, which I think is out soon.
All right.
If you like that kind of thing, you know, I would suggest checking those out.
Okay. Cora.
Well, it is a sort of very close retelling of The Little Mermaid, but it's actually, The Little Mermaid is a very, most Hans Christian Andersen stories are very dark. The Little Mermaid is a very, very dark story, the original, not the Disney-fied version, because the mermaid, yes, she gets legs, she gets to go on land, but the prince never falls in love with her, and she cannot speak, and she always has pain walking. And like Lisa said, things go a bit too easy for this mermaid. And also, I don't really think it's a mermaid, it's some kind of alien mer creature. And also, someone said, why doesn't she just use a spacesuit? I'm pretty sure there will be spacesuits for water breathers in this world. But yes, I love the diverse crew. I think it's one of the more, it's more interesting than the fairy tale retellings we had a few years ago, which basically just maybe swapped out the land of the prince. Then there was one which just swapped, which just basically said, okay, both fairy tale princesses now fall in love, which was really like, okay, that one was kind of predictable. This one was a bit more interesting, but it actually could have gone more into the darkness of the original story. So because this mermaid basically, she gets everything he wants. The ship crew accepts her. She has great friends. She has no issues walking, even though she's never walked before. She doesn't have the pain. Also, she can speak. The original mermaid can't speak. She's mute. She cannot speak, so she cannot even tell this prince that she loves him. And yes, and then in the end, she gets to go home. She meets her sister. I think if Hans Christian Andersen would have written this one, the sister would have been dead and long gone to bones or something like that. She has to pay the price. She gets to be the sea witch. But is it really that awful being the sea witch? I don't think so. I liked it. I liked it, but I didn't like it as much as some of the others, especially Metal Like Blood in the Dark does something a lot more interesting with the fairy tale telling. It also goes more into the darkness of the original story, because Hansel and Gretel, of course, also is a very dark story.
Yeah. Go ahead, Laurie.
I wanted to touch back on what Lisa had said that I completely agree with about the lack of conflict. For me, the story, I thought it was fine. And there are definitely things about it that I like. But when I finished reading it, I was just kind of like, well, huh, okay. But if I'm being fair, I read all these stories at the same time. I sat down one evening and read all of them. And so I think reading this right after I had just been trapped in the shipping container with the new moms and the zombie apocalypse, I feel like maybe that's part of why I felt that way, because I don't mind a story that is just kind of a snapshot of someone's life or just a little vignette of another world. So I think now that we're talking about it, it makes me realize that there are more things about the story that I liked when I initially read it. And I do think that's probably because it was juxtaposed against these other stories that definitely have a lot more conflict going on or a lot more excitement. But I wanted to also go back to what Haley said, and I mentioned this briefly in the chat too, when you read the last line, Haley, where she said, "I now understand the motions of celestial bodies. I don't need to leave home in order to journey through the universe." That immediately reminded me of the end of The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy wakes up in her bed and says, you know, if I want adventures, or I can't remember exactly what she said, but she said, "I don't need to look any further than my own backyard." And The Wizard of Oz was a movie that my much younger brother watched on loop for a while when we were kids. And so I've seen it millions of times, and I really like the movie and I like all the music. But every time you get to the end, I think to myself, what is this lesson? I'm not sure what the lesson is. And I felt like that at the end of this story too. I'm not sure what the lesson is, because she gained so much knowledge and friendships and experience and that she can share with others when she takes her place as the witch. So I'm not sure what we're supposed to take away from that last line. And it has to be important. I mean, it's the second to last line of the story, so I think it has to be important, but I don't really know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Cora, did you want to react to that?
Yes. I mean, I do see what the lesson is. I mean, it's a really, home is the most best place of all. It's a really, really common lesson, especially and not just exclusively in fiction aimed at children. I mean, there's a Wizard of Oz. It's in a lot of fairy tales. Narnia is also sort of, I have to admit, I've never read that because it wasn't available where I live when I was at the right age, and now it would just be silly. Alice in Wonderland, there's a lot of this whole lesson, like, okay, you have these wonderful adventures in this absolutely wonderful place, and now you get to go home. I mean, that's also what Shauna McGuire is more or less going against a bit in Wayward Children series, because those children don't want to be back in the real world. They don't think home is the best place. And also, as someone who was adventurous as a kid, also, it's not just a kid thing. In Germany, we had a genre of movies called Heimatfilme, basically homeland films in the 1950s, which were all about people who went away to the big city and then they come back to their little Alpine village and everybody's wearing dirndl dresses and lederhosen and they are so lovely and it's such a wonderful place and home is the best place. And if you want to go live in the city, it's awful. And yeah, I hated those movies as a kid because I said, like, I don't want dirndl dresses. And I'm not even from that part of Germany. I'm from the opposite part where we don't wear that. And I want a big city. I don't want this thing. And yeah, so it's a lesson I have problems with. This is a lesson that it's not actually a lesson really in the original fairy tale. tale, but this is sort of the lesson which I feel like home is the best place, and it's not necessarily a wrong lesson, but it's just something I have a bit of an issue with. So yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that is a message that can resonate, because it's how many rom-coms have that exact same plot. But Sarah, I think you had something to say.
Yeah, just that I was happy there wasn't some pirate attack on the starship. I find pirate stories and zombie port stories pretty boring and glorifying of violence. You know, I think there's nothing, I don't think it is bad storytelling to not have that kind of conflict in it. I think there are a lot of good ways to tell stories, and it's fine that that's not everybody's jam. It's fine that there are people who've read, you know, hundreds of zombie and post-apocalyptic stories. I've read a lot of post-apocalyptic stories, but that's not what everyone wants to read. And so just, you know, just a little more defense this kind of story. It's not my top story, but I think it was very well told for what that story was about. You know, the author wanted to tell that story, and I liked the way they told that story.
Yeah. All right. Any other comments on this one? I think we only have one left. Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to Little Free Library. And for the plot summary, we have Cora.
Well, Little Free Library is a story by Naomi Kritzer, which was published at Torcom. And it's a story of Megan, a young woman from St. Paul in Minnesota, who installs a Little Free Library, which is a sort of, it looks a little bit like a birdhouse, and it's like a cupboard where you can put books in and people can take out a book and leave a book. We have something similar, but usually it's old phone booths. So the boxes are a bit bigger. This one is just a really small box, and she makes it really lovely and puts in books. And she's a fantasy fan, so there's lots of fantasy books mentioned. And yeah, one day someone clears out all the books. And yes, she knows that happens sometimes, but she's a bit cross because you're just supposed to take one book and leave something and leave a note like, okay, nice that you like the books, but don't sell them. They're for reading, and please leave something next time. And so suddenly she starts getting weird gifts like strange painted stones, strange feathers and leaves, which have no real equivalent in our world. And also she starts getting notes from someone who really apologizes for taking all the books and turns out to be a fantasy fan, because he asks for more parts of the story of Frodo. He wants to know how, you know, because he only has one, he only puts in the Fellowship of the Ring, because she has an extra copy, and so she gets more from. She starts corresponding with this strange borrower, and initially she just thinks it's an artist who leaves these strange artistic gifts for her. But then she finds out that these feathers or leaves don't exist in our world. So that's very strange, and gets even stranger when she puts in a book about defending a castle. And this one really, really, really resonates with this mystery borrower. He says, thank you, you're solving our problems. Now we can protect our queen. And apparently it's some kind of alien or fantasy being. And this person also starts leaving gold coins for her in exchange for more practical books about practical tips for defending yourself and medieval warfare. And then they said, okay, we're preparing for the final battle. And she doesn't hear from this person again, but she has a gold tested, and it's real gold and very valuable. And then in the end, she gets another message like, oh, it's so awful. We lost, even though we had the better technology, but we were still outnumbered, but we were able to save. Our last hope is the heir to the throne, the child of our queen. And what does she find in her Little Free Library? An egg. She takes the egg inside to keep it warm. So now she's the guardian to the heir of an alien, of a throne of alien bird people or whatever they are. And okay, so that's the story. And it's a really, really fun story, which just resonated with me, because it's a story about, well, people who love books and who bond over books, even if one of them isn't even human.
I actually have a lot of thoughts about this one. Okay. I used to live in the Twin Cities area of Minnesota, and these little free libraries are everywhere. I'd never heard of one before we moved there, and I actually got the Fated Sun trilogy that someone mentioned out of one of these little free libraries. So that part was just delightful. It felt very accurate. One thing that drives me crazy about this story, though, is like we don't really know if she's helping the good guys, right? Like,
right.
She could be helping the villains of this story, and the egg that she's giving away could be this like evil dragon demon that like the good guys in Lord of the Rings fashion just defeated or something. Like, we don't know. I got to the end of this story and like I was totally engaged in every step. I was waiting for the next letter. I was ready for it. And then it just ends. And I almost, like, I feel a sense of loss here. Like, where's the rest of the story? Like, so I'm really torn about this one because I loved it. It just resonated with me on almost every level. But I also think, like, it needs to have some sequels happening, like, tomorrow, because I need to know what happens. I need to know if I'm going for the good guys or not. I need to know what's in that egg. Like, I have to know. So I'm hoping that she writes more. This one's one of the top tier ones for me, but yeah, I'll let other people chime in, but I loved it.
Yeah. Ivor, why don't you go ahead and go?
Yeah, love this story as well. But again, the egg thing was also a thing that bothered me. Since we have a Game of Thrones, the egg's in that. But given my age, I think more the egg from Alien. I don't want to be in the house when that hatches. Thank you very much.
Yep. Alan, go ahead.
So, I did like the whimsical nature of the story. I did think it was fun. I love the references in it. But for me, I felt very flat. And maybe I think JD brought up the ending, and maybe that's why it felt really flat to me, because I kept like thinking, okay, and then what? And it just kind of, like you said, it just ended and I was waiting for more. And so a lot of people's criticism about Mermaid Astronaut is kind of how I felt about this story.
Yeah. Yeah, different stories hit different people in different ways. Lisa, why don't you go ahead?
The alien roots for Frodo. Of course, he's a good guy.
That might be a clue in the right direction. Any other thoughts on this one?
I guess if he had asked for more stories about that Sauron guy, we would have known.
Maybe. Yeah. Go ahead, Laurie.
So I saw something recently, it was probably a tweet or something, that said one of the early symptoms of gentrification is a little free library popping up in a neighborhood. And I thought of that when the books were cleared out and she left the note saying, oh, you know, please only take two or three at a time. And there was the mention of like people selling the books. And I just immediately thought, like, no one's getting rich off of selling used books. And that's like been kind of a topic of discussion recently, because there was a story about a local police department that was kind of presenting itself as like doing something cute by protecting a little free library from having all the books taken. And the public reaction was like, books are supposed to be taken. So, you know, you don't want somebody to come and take all the books. I understand that. But I kind of got off on the wrong foot with this story a little bit, with the opening of her leaving a note saying, don't take them all. And like, the person who took them all really was reading them. So I kind of just had like a gut reaction at the beginning of the story to the protagonist that I didn't love. And then it went a little downhill for me too when the borrower started leaving the gifts, because I think that note made her feel like, or made the borrower feel like they needed to leave something in exchange for the books. And so I didn't love that either. And I think it's a neat story, and I like, you know, the idea that the little free library is a portal, and that there's this cultural exchange, even though like no one on either side of it really is aware of what they're doing, but or who, you know, who they're exchanging with. So I think there are definitely some interesting things in it. The egg at the end is great. JW, I love the like idea of are we helping the good guys? Are we helping the bad guys? So I think that puts a really interesting spin on it. But I just had like a little trouble. I think the story and I got off on the wrong foot and didn't quite recover.
Yeah. Haley put in the chat that people use little free libraries sometimes as garbage dumps for books that they don't want anymore, like Windows technical manuals and stuff. That reminds me of at my work, every 7 years, we get an 8-week sabbatical. And usually when somebody's away on sabbatical, they come back to their cubicle dressed up in some kind of way. And everybody in my group knew that I loved books. And so they filled my cubicle with books. They put up things all over the place. Hey, if you have books you want to get rid of, give them to us. And so there, it was probably 2/3 like old programmers reference manuals from like Pentium days and stuff. And yeah, there was some interesting stuff in there too, but I had a lot of books that just went in the recycler after that. Go ahead, Cora.
Well, I mean, about whether she's helping the villains or not, of course, every side in a war thinks that they're the good guys. No one thinks of themselves as the villains. Even the Nazis didn't think they were villains, even though they very, very much were. Well, no one thinks of themselves. And so we don't really know what sort of war this is. Of course, at least they're talking about defending themselves, and they're apparently under siege, which suggests that the aggressors are the other side because you wouldn't be under siege unless, of course, they try to conquer the other side first and then had to retreat and are now under siege. We just don't know. And I think, just like Megan, I decided to assume that, yes, these are probably the good guys. And about the egg, I really want the sequel now where Megan is raising a baby dragon or something like that, or maybe a baby bird creature. I actually thought it was either something reptilian like a dragon or some kind of bird creature because there were feathers in the library at one point.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Go ahead, JW.
Yeah, so one thing I was wondering with like the defense was happening, right? So the aggressors are attacking this person who's getting all these books, but like, it almost sounds like there's like some aspect of royalty. So like, to me, it's almost like, are they overthrowing their like ruthless monarchy that, you know, is now sort of trying to defend itself from them with these castle manuals and stuff. And I guess for me, like a huge part of the fun of this book was filling in the gaps, because there's a lot of gaps here. Like, we don't know almost anything other than that there's a library, books disappear, and they get paid for. With Lori's point, I just really wanted to say, like, I love that was something that was off-putting to you, because I also felt that way with, you know, the books are put in the Little Free Library because they're free books. Like, you can take them. If you want to take all of them, go for it. And it kind of makes me think about, you know, giving money to someone who needs it, and like how often we kind of try to attach strings to those things. And it's not like, no, once you've put money in the hand of someone else, once you've put a book in that Little Free Library, like, it's theirs. Like, they can have it. They can do what they want with it. So I appreciated that point.
Yeah. Sarah, go ahead.
There was a reference at the end to Our Lady, and that does kind of sound to me like at least, if not royalty, some kind of gentility structured society. So yeah, I'm enjoying all these alternate interpretations that, you know, it was a revolt against, you know, some neo-feudal society or something like that. I enjoy all the interpreted alternate readings that other people came up with that I didn't. I guess I just read it in a kind of whimsical twee fashion. So I didn't think of the darker readings, and I'm enjoying other people's imaginations.
Yep. Cora, go ahead.
Sorry, you just forgot to take the hand down.
We can't hear you, Seth.
Now I've forgotten the mute button. I just haven't muted myself very often. Sorry about that. Maybe I will edit out that pause. No, I won't. So any other thoughts on this one, or we can move into kind of summing up overall, you know, people can say what their favorite is, or a couple favorites. So why don't we just go ahead and go in order if we don't have any other thoughts on this one, in my order on my screen. So JW, why don't you go first?
I'm sorry. We're looking at what our favorites are.
Yeah. Yeah. Just any overall thoughts about the group of stories, or if you have a favorite or a couple favorites?
For me, my favorites are all of them except for the mermaid astronaut. Sorry to those who enjoyed it. If I had to choose, I think Metal Like Blood in the Dark is, like I said, I think the strongest prose. And Little Free Library is the one that I've thought about the most afterwards. So for me, those are probably the top two, with the Haunted House one just being the one that caught me off guard. So if I had to pick, it's among those three. I just can't decide, so I'm going to let other people decide for me by voting.
Okay. Lisa, what about you?
If I were voting, a guide for working breach would be on top. And I think the Badass Moms would be number two. Very feminist, like that.
Yeah. All right. What about you, Alan?
So first, I want to say I thought all the stories were pretty excellent overall. The top three for me, and the reason I'm saying top three is because I'm talking splitting hairs here. I thought they were all extremely good stories. Number one, Guide for Working Breeds, Number two for me would be mermaid astronaut. And number three for me would be the open house on Haunted Hill.
Nice. How about you, Lori?
I did enjoy all of the stories, but the my top three would be open house on Haunted Hill, Guide for Working Breeds, and Badass Moms of the Zombie Apocalypse. And I think I'm going to struggle with, I am voting this year, so I'm going to struggle with which one is number one. And I think that's going to be down to Open House on Haunted Hill and Guide for Working Breeds, because those two I just thought were fantastic.
Nice. Cora?
Well, I'm also a Hugo voter, and I will have really problems ranking these stories because they're all good. Good. There's no real real outlier, which isn't really my thing, because there's no award. I don't use it a lot, but sometimes there is a story I really don't like. There was one last year which I know awarded in this category, but there's no award, and there's also no case of the okay, I don't really care for this one, it's kind of mediocre, but it's not really no award awful, so I just put it in last place. But here, even this number six story will be a story I like and that I might have placed very high on my list in the previous year. And my top three are Little Free Library and Open House on Haunted Hill and Metal Like Blood in the Dark. And I think I will probably be reshuffling the rankings several times until the voting deadline, which happens occasionally. I mean, this is one of those years where I just like to say, okay, can I maybe vote for all of them in number one or have a tie? But the Hugos don't work that way.
Yep. Okay, Ivor.
Okay, I'm not just right at the bottom of the pile, the knowledge of science fiction, but I tend to look at books and stories and try and sum it up with one word. So just bear with me a second. So what was how associated with the story? So I said open house to me was loneliness. Metal Like Blood was self-development. Mermaid was curiosity. Little Free Library was knowledge. Guide to Working Breeds was identity. And Badass was survival. So the two for me at the top would be open house and Metal Like Blood, just the edge to Metal Like Blood.
All right. How about you, Amy?
I am very much looking forward to rereading these now that we've had this conversation, because I think that everybody's insight is going to change the way I see them. So with that caveat, I will say that I also very much enjoyed all the stories, maybe with the exception of the Little Mermaid, maybe. But my top three are in no particular order are Badass Moms of the Zombie Apocalypse, A Guide for Working Breeds, and Metal Like Blood in the Dark.
All right. And Haley.
The most interesting concept for me was the Little Free Library one, for sure. So, but they were all enjoyable. And I am a notorious short story hater. So this was a fun experiment for me, and I enjoyed them. So
nice. All right, Sarah.
So this is my first time voting in Hugo's. For this category, right, none of these are going to fall below no award for me, unlike some of the other categories. I've read all of the books, novellas, novelettes, short stories. I've made it through most of the categories for the Hugos, and for some of them, some works will absolutely fall below no award for me. But for the short stories, absolutely any of them could be good for a Hugo. For me, the top two are Metal Like Blood in the Dark and
All right. Did we get the end of your sentence? I feel like you got cut off. Anybody else? Or was I phasing out?
I think she got cut off.
Yeah, I think, Sarah, you got cut off. All right, we'll circle back to you. I'll go ahead and say mine. I think it's a very strong group of stories. I didn't love them all the first time, but I found something to enjoy in each of them on a reread. And I think my favorite is Metal Like Blood in the Dark. I just love the prose in that one. I love the whole description of the wings that the brother was making. I thought that was really cool. And Open House on Haunted Hill is probably a close second for me. I just thought that one was very sweet. But yeah, I don't think I end up with any below no award, because I enjoyed something in all of them. We appear to have lost Sarah. So let's go ahead and move into, you know, final thoughts. If you want to give any information about where people can find you, we kind of already did that in the intros, but I want to make sure that we come back to that before we sign off. And I want to say thank you to everybody for doing this. Really, really appreciate it. You know, sometimes you put something out on Twitter and you think nobody's going to respond. I thought I could probably get Lori, Haley, and Amy to do something, but I really appreciate everybody who volunteered. And once I had Lori in the door, I thought, okay, I bet we get all three. So that was cool. And thank you for being flexible about the time as well, especially for Lisa and Cora. I know that it's later in the day for you than it is for the rest of us. So I appreciate that. So final thoughts from anybody? Go ahead and just unmute yourself and say something if you'd like. Oh, we got Sarah back and we have video.
How weird. okay. Sorry. Do you want me to re-say what I said about the Hugos or did you actually get it for the voting?
I think you got cut off right in the middle of your ranking. So,
okay. So to sum up, all these short stories above no award for me, all of them are Hugo worthy. The top two for me are, Metal Like Blood in the Dark and A Guide to Working Breed. I think each of those had some very different strengths from each other. I think they're both great. I'd love for either of them to win. And you know, the other stories are pretty good too. There are some of the other categories where I would put some as under no award, but for this category, it was a delight. And I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks everybody.
Yeah. Thanks for joining. All right. Anybody else? Go ahead and unmute and say your final thoughts or sign off.
I'll go. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to everybody. I'm just a reader and this has been a great experience. And I'd like to say, because I got into Seth's podcast at the same time as doing the crossover with the Hugo Girl podcast. Nice. So both podcasts could give me reading material, thoughts. And I love both perspectives. And secondly, I'm way outclassed on this. I've been looking forward to seeing the notes as to all the blogs, etc., so I can get to them. But discussion like this makes reading enjoyable, and it's good to hear everybody's opinion on this. So thank you. It's been very worthwhile.
Excellent. And by the way, I've felt the same way on panels before, and we're all equals here. And I thought it was a great discussion, and you were terrific.
Wanted to say great job moderating too. You know, with this size group, I kind of wondered how it was going to go, and I think that this went really well, and I really enjoyed it and had a lot of fun. So thank you and good job.
Well, whoever had the first idea to use the raise your hand icon really gets the credit for that, because I hadn't even thought of that. I think it was Amy or Sarah. But thank you for that. That helped a great deal.
Well, I also want to say,
I'm so happy to have been on this episode with all of you. I'm so honored. I usually organize a small event where we read all the short stories, both the Hugo finalists and the Nebula nominees. I haven't been able to do that this year, so this is what I did instead. And this, awesome. This it's very nice. So
cool. Go ahead, Cora.
Well, I also wanted to say thank you for hosting this discussion. And I think it's also one thing I wish more people would know is that we have a lot of really, really great science fiction and fantasy related podcasts out there. And I hope that more people listen. When I did those podcast interviews, I found so many great podcasts to listen to. It really messed up my entire Hugo ballot because I suddenly have I could have nominated 10 podcasts, but I only get 5. So yeah, I hope more people listen to all of the great different podcasts we have out there. And also really great that we have a largely good Hugo year. There are some categories where I'm not happy with dramatic presentation long because most of those movies are not really my taste, but everything else I'm really happy with. But people can find me. You can find my blog at corabulot.com, my name. So currently I'm doing episode-by-episode reviews of the Foundation TV series. You can also find me at galacticjourney.org, which is like a regular fanzine. So we talk about movies, science fiction books, and magazines. But 55 years in the past. And right now, my colleagues are talking about Star Trek, which just premiered last month. So that's quite exciting. And otherwise, just thank you. It was we had a great time. I had a great time.
Well, it was great having you. And it's nice to meet, the folks who I hadn't met before. So that's awesome. I want to make sure, Alan, give out your contact info for your podcast.
So like everybody else said, thank you so much for having this and inviting me on. That was fantastic. My podcast is If This Goes On, Don't Panic. check us out. We've got a couple episodes coming up soon, an interview with Rem Wigmore, who just wrote Fox Hunt, or just published Fox Hunt, I should say. We're going to be interviewing the editors of Solar Punk magazine, and also the chairs of Fans Forward. So that's what we've got coming up. And you can find us in any podcasting platform. Just if this goes on, parentheses, don't panic.
Nice. Okay. And then somebody from Hugo Girl should say where you can be found. Amy, why don't you take one for the team?
Yeah, I can go ahead. So Hugo Girl podcast can be found on any platform as well. And you can reach us at HugoGirlPodcast@gmail.com. And we are on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, Hugo Girl Podcast. So come find us. Tell us what you think. Be nice.
Awesome. And thank you.
And make Lori's year by leaving a review.
Yes.
Yes, please.
Good idea. Yep. All right. JW, do you want to say anything before we sign off? Off mute, preferably.
Yes. Sorry. Yep. So again, my blog can be found on eclectictheist.wordpress.com. Talk about a lot of sci-fi fantasy on there. And I'm also on Twitter at JW Wartick, WARTICK. So thank you for having me on, and thank you for hosting, and thank you everyone else for all of your comments. Like, I just really had a great time. So thank you all.
Yeah. Sarah, did you give any contact info, or did you want to?
Oh, people can find me on Twitter at configures. I'm not doing a lot of other, I consume a lot of podcasts and books. Okay. And so on, but occasional guesting here and there, but I am pretty active on Twitter, science fiction and tech stuff and occasional random pretty things.
Okay. Well, I'm about to hit stop recording, so I'm going to say goodbye. Everybody can wave goodbye, say goodbye, and then I'm going to hit stop, but don't hang up yet. So bye, everybody.